Welcome to Inside Healthcare, critical thinking for turbulent times. Your host is Robert Chamberlain. Our show takes an honest look at the healthcare industry at a time when there are more questions in this industry than ever before. Now, here is your host, Robert Chamberlain.
And good Monday morning. This is Robert Chamberlain live from beautiful downtown Nashville, Tennessee, the country music and healthcare capital of the world. I am your host, Robert Chamberlain. I'm happy to be here, and welcome to Inside Healthcare, Critical Thinking for Turbulent Times. And as the intro stated, we like to take a look at the healthcare industry in general, and specifically hospitals, health systems, and physicians, and how all this plugs together to create an increasingly interesting mosaic with a very interesting industry that's evolving in a number of different directions. We always like to begin each show by taking a look at events of the previous week. So as always, joining me today is Ms. Holly West, who's Executive Vice President of Communications and Operations at Applied Health Analytics. Good morning, Holly.
Morning, Bob.
Hey, Holly, let's start where we somewhat ended up last week. We're talking about big data, and had a discussion around is big data the panacea for the industry, or is big data potentially a big concern? And we've learned about community health systems and a breach that they experienced. Tell me a little bit about that and where that stands today.
Well, that breach, which exposed more than 4 million patients' data in 29 states, is expected to cost between $75 and $150 million, according to a calculation at Forbes. The first action lawsuit was filed within hours after the breach was announced. And keep in mind that earlier this year, an attorney from the Office for Civil Rights said its crackdown on HIPAA violations over the past year will pale in comparison to what will be coming up in the next 12 months. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee estimated the total bill at $17 million for the breach that it had 2 years ago, involving about 1 million patient records. That included $7 million to improve its internal security and $1.5 million settlement with OCR, but it did not have patient or shareholder lawsuits. So experts believe hackers used the computer bug Heartbleed to access the systems in the CHS breach. The FBI recently issued a flash alert warning that hackers are targeting healthcare organizations.
So big data has a big target on it, backed by lawyers who are interested in fanning those flames. And my understanding that the CHS hack was a group out of China. And we recently learned just later last week that healthcare.gov was hacked. So I think we can expect to see more of this. It's going to be a big concern for IT professionals within the healthcare industry. And let's hope that we can mitigate the exposure and make it less of the target that it seems to be. But we're also seeing a lot of financial results come out, Holly, with somewhat mixed news. Tell me what you're seeing.
Well, according to unaudited data, the Mayo Clinic's net income rose 74% during the first half of 2014 to $347 million, compared to $197 million during the first half of 2013. Its revenue was relatively flat, up 5% to close to $4.8 billion, compared to last year's first half revenue of $4.6 billion. Mayo cited the bump in net income as related to the enactment of the ACA starting in 2014. For-profit hospital chains such as HCA Holdings, Tenet Healthcare Corp, and Universal Health Services also reported a rise in earnings as a result of the ACA. LifePoint Hospitals, Inc. recently reported a 44% increase in its profits.
And much of this is largely attributed to the states that did the Medicaid expansion, where a lot of these hospitals and health systems, such as Minnesota, are benefiting from a larger portion of the uninsured now participating in insurance. What about, what are you hearing out of SSM Health?
Well, we have a little more information on the St. Louis-based healthcare company. SSM reported $2 billion in total revenue for the first 6 months of the year, which is a 40% year-over-year increase. SSM's operating income of $82 million for the first half of 2014, compared with a $1 million operating loss in the first 6 months of 2013. And the key drivers of the increase were cited as significant savings from a financial improvement plan the system implemented in the fourth quarter of last year, in addition to revenue cycle improvements. Operating EBITDA was $221 million for the first 6 months of this year, up from $105 million in the first half of 2013. Their overall surplus increased by 55% from $72 million in 2013 to $112 million. Net patient service revenue rose 4% year over year to $71 million. Hospital acute admissions dropped by 1% in the first half of 2014 compared with 2013.
Well, and I think the thing to keep in mind here is we're seeing very significant increases in the percentages of EBITDA. But when you take a look at the fact these are multi-billion dollar organizations, the overall operating margin remains very, very thin. So we're very happy to see the operating income up, but we're still concerned about margin, particularly as it relates to volumes. On the other side of the coin, though, we're seeing Moody's doing some interesting things relative to how they look at not-for-profit hospitals. What do you see there?
Well, we are. So I have a quote for you. According to John D. Rockefeller, during the Great Depression, these are the days when many are discouraged. Despite the fact that the ACA is delivering a million more patients into the healthcare system, most nonprofit hospitals are still waiting to see a positive impact to their bottom lines. In fact, revenue growth among nonprofit hospitals is at its lowest level since the Great Recession. Hence my quote. According to a new report by Moody's Investor Service, revenue grew only by 4% last year, according to the report, down from 5% revenue growth hospitals saw in 2012, and far lower than the 7% growth it had seen in recent years. Inpatient admissions were down 1% last year after several years of being flat. Growth rates for outpatient admissions also slowed. Factors that stymied revenue growth include a shift to more outpatient visits, which pay at a lower level than inpatient admissions, close scrutiny of short-stay hospital stays, cuts in hospital payments, tough operating environments where expenses are hard to control, and the continued effects of the sequester cut. Moody's cited that the typical rate increase for not-for-profits has remained flat to no more than 5%. That trend is compounded by more cost shifting to healthcare plan enrollees, creating an unsteady payment stream that hospitals must collect on their own. Last year, Moody issued its sixth consecutive negative outlook for hospitals, and although the growth of the insured from Medicaid expansion and subsidized coverage from the ACA will likely be a mitigating factor for hospitals' finances, Moody does not expect any significant effects to hit their bottom lines until at least 2015.
Inpatient admissions going down, outpatient going up, overall revenue declining. We're also seeing a lot of influence from market disruptors, such as we'll be talking about in just a moment, Walgreens and CVS, and siphoning off a lot of that very high-quality primary care revenue. But we're also, I wonder if a lot of this, Holly, has anything to do with the shift towards preventive care. And the fact that we're seeing a lot more mergers and acquisitions and affiliations, which results in more operational cuts. But in any case, as we see hospitals trying to react to this new environment, there is a lot of collaboration. There seems to be a lot of development and partnerships. What are you seeing there?
There is. Cleveland Clinic finalizes Akron General Health System's minority ownership deal.
Okay.
Memorial Hospital and Manor in Bainbridge, Georgia, joins Stratus Healthcare.
I think that makes that a 14 hospital system now.
Pretty big. Duke Life Point in Brentwood, Tennessee, and Conemaugh, sorry for mispronouncing that, health system in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, reached a definitive acquisition agreement.
Yeah, it's a state that we've seen a lot of acquisitions and mergers take place.
I felt maybe it was about 2 weeks ago, I felt our entire merger discussion was centered around Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And then Weiser Memorial Hospital and Boise, Idaho-based St. Luke's Health System signed a letter of intent to consider integration.
And we keep an eye on Kingsport, Tennessee, as we await to hear the outcome of the Wellmont Health System relationship. Understanding is that's now down to three finalists who are interested in acquiring or at least partnering with Wellmont Health System. We talked a little bit about innovation and market disruptors. We're seeing a lot of activity in the emergency department field. What's going on there, Holly?
I actually thought this one was pretty interesting. Hospitals interested in gaining market share are investing in ventures that are likely to grow or secure specific groups of patients. The latest type of venture is the freestanding emergency department. Freestanding EDs in states in which they are legal are attracted to those looking for the care a traditional ED provides, but want a faster, more pleasant experience. Unlike the typical ED patient, these patients are insured. The attraction to providers, potential increases in margins for everyone who can capture the patient. Like retail clinics, especially those with a primary care model, the placement and construction of freestanding EDs may act as disruptors and competitors, or they could act as potential partners. Freestanding ED operator Adeptus Health already has about 50 sites under development across the country, well, mainly in Texas. For legal and economic reasons, they are in Texas, although Adeptus is expanding to other states as well. Adeptus and hospitals like it. They are looking to capture the same patient that might use a hospital, with one caveat: except all patients are privately insured. They market convenience and lower cost to attract their patients who are mostly who mostly live in suburban areas. For large hospital systems putting up their own freestanding EDs, Adeptus is a competitor. For smaller hospital systems, however, they are a potential market partner. Adeptus is looking actively looking to partner with local hospitals.
Well, whether they're a competitor or a partner, the fact is the front of primary care is moving once again, and we have new entrants coming into the market that represent a challenge for hospitals and health systems. These innovators and these early adopters siphon off high-quality reimbursement by focusing on what you'd expect, and that's convenience, a high-touch environment, one-stop care. Perhaps just the attraction of getting a single bill from one place for the provision of that care is enough to attract people. Well, so we have Adeptus, we have Care Here, we had Ernie Clevenger here on the show not long ago talking about his model, but we also have a couple of titans in the form of CVS and Walgreens. Who's going to win in that healthcare collaboration battle?
Yes, in the ultimate match, there is the competition between these two retail health systems. Both CVS Caremark and rival Walgreens has formed partnerships with hospitals and health systems, but who is the king of collaboration? CVS recently announced it had entered into a clinical affiliation with Washington, D.C.-based MedStar Health, a 10-hospital system with facilities in Maryland and the Washington, D.C. area. Through the affiliation, MedStar Health patients will receive chronic disease monitoring, medication counseling, and other clinical support at CVS stores and CVS's retail healthcare clinic, which is MinuteClinic. The MedStar Health affiliation brings CVS's total number of affiliations with hospitals and health systems to 41. And according to a Forbes report, CVS has 8 clinical collaborations since May. Walgreens is the second largest chain with approximately 400 clinics throughout the U.S. The chain has more than 20 affiliations with hospitals and health systems. So in terms of output, CVS wins. However, earlier this summer, Walgreens launched an extension of its Balance Reward program. The Balance Rewards for Healthy Choices initiative rewards members for participating in various health-related programs and tracking the progress.
So, Holly, are you suggesting that Walgreens and CVS are getting into the disease management business?
I believe they are.
It certainly looks like it. So, once again, here comes a new form of new face of competition. We love the innovation. We think it's fantastic. We're seeing that the government is starting to look at telemedicine a little bit differently, but also the states are weighing in on telemedicine. What news do you have there?
Yes, they are. Well, more than a month ago, we discussed CMS's proposed rules for telemedicine reimbursement. Well, the Georgia Composite Medical Board recently passed a rule that requires a clinician to have examined a patient in person before providing telemedicine services. According to the rule, a physician, physician assistant, or advanced practice registered nurse must have personally seen and examined the patient and provide ongoing or intermittent care by electronic or other means. But as with every rule, there are exceptions. One to this rule is the use of advanced technology and devices that allow for a consultation equal to or superior in quality than what can be done in person. I'm not really sure how they're defining equal and superior then.
All right, we'll keep an eye on that and report back. As always, thank you, Holly. It's always insightful and helpful. We appreciate you on the show today. When we come back, we're going to have with us Beth Kuchar, who's a healthcare finance reporter with Modern Healthcare, and we're going to ask for her insight and see how she weighs in on recent developments in the industry as well. We'll see you in just a moment.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
When it comes to staying well or fighting disease, medicine knows more than it ever has. In fact, more medical knowledge has been created in the last 50 years than in the previous 500 years combined. Think about that. Promising new procedures, innovations in prevention, coming at a faster and faster pace. So how do you get medicine's greatest ideas working for you? It takes a system. At Carolina's healthcare system, thousands of doctors are connected across 900 locations, so doctors, specialists, and surgeons can share ideas across the hall or across the state. Our integrated system gives all your doctors instant access to your test results and health history, so everyone's working together, diagnosing and delivering your care. Today, building this culture of continuous learning takes a system. Connecting a network of care takes a system. Your health takes a system, working as one. To find out more, go to carolinashealthcare.org.
Ever since I was a little girl, I've been dreaming of the day that my dad would get all dressed up and walk me down the aisle on my wedding day. I even planned what he would wear, how his tux would go with my dress, things like that. I remember thinking he'll have a little more gray hair by then, but he'll still be the handsomest dad ever. Then he had his heart attack. My mom gave him aspirin and drove him to the Halifax Health Chest Pain Center. All these people were running around, moving really fast, and my dad just looked helpless, lifeless. They tried this amazing new thing, lowering his body temperature to some exact degree to protect his heart and give him a chance. They called it intravascular hypothermia treatment. They did everything they could. They took great care of him every second. And because they did, he'll be taking care of me for years to come. And now I know he'll be there to walk me down the aisle.
Halifax Health. Live your life well.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are listening to Inside Healthcare with Robert Chamberlain. If you would like to participate on today's show with a question or a comment, please call into our show live on Mondays at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to insidehealthcare@appliedhealth.net. Now, back to this week's program.
And welcome back to Inside Healthcare. I'm your host, Robert Chamberlain. I want to thank Holly West for the news of the week. As always, there's a lot of activity taking place, and it's important to stay on top of that. And while we're staying on top of things, there are a few organizations within the industry that stay on top of healthcare and all of its happening than Modern Healthcare Magazine itself. And we're very, very pleased to have joining us today Beth Kuchar, who is the healthcare finance reporter for Modern Healthcare, which, of course, is the industry's leading source for healthcare business and policy research and information. Beth previously served as the content editor and pharmaceutical reporter at New York-based Merger Market Group. Her work has appeared in Crain's Detroit Business, FT.com, PR Week, Medical Marketing and Media, and the Staten Island Advance. She is a graduate of Cornell, and where she serves as the editor of the Cornell Daily Sun. Good morning, Beth. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I got to tell you, I've been looking forward to this. I'm a primary advocate of what you write, and I think the insight is impressive. So, I've got a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about. You cover merger and acquisition activity at Modern Healthcare, and we know that there's been an unprecedented level of merger and acquisition activity. Could you share with us what you're seeing, and you know which systems have been recently active? Are you seeing any trends? Can you talk about what you're experiencing out there and how that might impact our audience?
Absolutely. So Modern Healthcare compiles a quarterly healthcare M&A watch report. We actually look at four sectors of the industry, so not just providers, but insurers, vendors, and life sciences companies. Really, last year was an interesting story because the provider space in particular was the one group that actually increased their year-over-year deal volume, while the other sectors pulled back a bit. 2014 is a different story entirely, and we're entering something of a seller's market. And we're seeing deal activity sort of level off, but value keeps spiking. And a lot of that is just easy access to financing, whether it's through the debt or equity markets, or just fewer high-quality targets that are still available, particularly in this environment where the Federal Trade Commission has been really active in scrutinizing in-market transactions.
You know, it's interesting because we've experienced consistent merger and acquisition activity on the for-profit side. Of course, that's the business model. Find high-value targets, bring them into the system, and use that to move the needle. But I'm also starting to sense that the not-for-profit side is picking up a little bit. Are you seeing a difference between for-profit and not-for-profit?
Well, the perennial acquirers, which would be the for-profits, are still in the market. And the not-for-profits are also looking to consolidate, but they've, and the bigger ones in particular, but you're also seeing some what I might call asset management. For instance, Ascension Health, one of the largest Catholic health systems in the country, has been, they recently stole a majority stake in Carondelet Health in Arizona, bringing in Tenet as a partner. And Catholic Health Initiatives has been looking, even as they look at hospital assets, they're also looking at insurance assets as well. So there's more diversification, there's more pruning on that side, there's much more thought about the strategic rationale in addition to just economies of scale like on the for-profit side.
Well, and that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. In previous years where we saw merger and acquisition activity, it was generally intended to gain scale, to not only help drive revenue growth on the for-profit side, but also as a means to create more of a competitive environment for hospitals in specific markets. But it seems to me that a lot of, which I would define as more of a as an aggressive move, and it seems to me that a lot of the mergers and acquisitions these days are almost defensive moves in the sense of go big or get out. We have to align. Is there a different motivation today than there was, say, 10 years ago?
Well, what we're seeing across the country is that inpatient volume is declining in most markets. And for the systems that are seeing volume increases, a lot of it is because of acquisitions or market share grab, if you will. And so some of these are exactly, as you say, defensive. There's also renewed interest in these non-ownership alliances, creating these networks for population health management. So we're going to partner, but we're only going to do it for back-office economies of scale, but we still want to maintain our independence. So that's another theme that's really emerging.
And another very important aspect here, and again, this is not new to the industry. It seems to be the second wave of physician alignment as hospitals and health systems seek physician integration strategies. And I remember reading a piece that you wrote in Modern Healthcare earlier this year that covered the issue of systems investing in physicians, whether they're employing them, purchasing their practices outright, or creating an ACO strategy. The feel from the article was that while physician integration is nothing new, it was too soon to tell whether these investments were paying off either directly or through downstream revenue. Have you come across any hospitals or health systems where the investment is starting to pay off?
I think it's too soon to tell with a lot of these. Northwestern recently had what's believed to be one of the largest physician practice deals in history. And, in their financial results, they saw a big boost in their surplus and their revenue. But, the operating margin continues to be very thin in their physician practice group, under 2%. The strategic rationale for buying physicians is eventually we're going to create these networks to manage population health, get patients in the door sooner for preventative care, manage them before they get ill, and align our electronic health records. But what it really comes down to now in terms of seeing a revenue gain, it's really, can we get referrals in the door? Can we sort of counteract the trend of declining volume? Can we take the volume from these physicians away from our competitors. So to the extent that a health system can do that, they might be seeing a payoff. But, you know, there's a lot of investment and a lot of overhead that comes with operating a physician practice group. So it's still, in terms of whether or not the population health rationale is going to pay off, you know, that really depends. You know, one thing we're hearing is that less than 10% of revenue, an immaterial amount, is coming from risk-based contracts. So if most of your revenue is still fee-for-service, you have to make these practices pay off in a fee-for-service model.
All right. So as we look at value-based care, many health systems have yet to stick their toe in the water. As they transition from pay-for-performance model, but there are some who are really operating in both. Can you share your thoughts about what challenges you're seeing hospitals face while they're trying to make this transition? It's a pretty big deal, and it's a very complicated transition.
It is complicated, especially because the fundamental paradox is that we're asking hospitals to stop doing the thing that they do best of all, which is, and get paid for, most importantly, which is get very sick people better and send them home. Now we're asking them to keep people out of the hospital to begin with, keep healthy people healthy, get them involved in their health care even before they need health care services. It's an entirely different way of doing business. And that's going to look different in each community. So for a rural health system where you might have patients coming hundreds of miles away who also have maybe social issues in getting care, you know, finding the support system to travel to your facility, you might want to be making investments in telemedicine and finding a way to make the reimbursement model for that. There's this whole question of interoperability or getting your electronic health record systems to talk to each other so that you can have the data, investing in the data and analytics. I cover a lot of earnings reports, and one thing I hear that a lot when I talk to CFOs and I say, you know, what went wrong with your balance sheet this past quarter, this past year? And they'll say, well, this was the year that we made our big electronic health records investment. But then, as I said before, you know, if you ask them, well, what percentage of your revenue is coming from these risk-based fee-for-value type contracts, it's, you know, very small. So, you know, you're making these huge investments, and the payment model isn't in place. And that's a huge challenge.
I know that CFOs are facing a lot of stress these days. I had a very unusual conversation with one not long ago who's running a pretty sizable health system, and I was asking, what does 2015 look like, and have you begun to put together a budget that discusses the relationship between volume, revenue, and bottom line? And he responded back to me saying, you know what, we no longer are doing annual budgeting. We're doing a rolling quarterly forecast based on our previous experience, which is remarkable to me. It suggests the turbulence and the headwinds that these individuals are facing these days. But you mentioned you also cover the insurance industry, Beth. Tell me, insurance, gosh, these guys are grappling with the repercussions of unhealthier people on the exchanges, which is causing them to petition the government to permit them to increase their reimbursement. They're also looking at their medical loss ratio standard under the Affordable Care Act and looking for ways to maximize the 20% that they can use for profit and administrative and other expenses. What are you seeing on the carrier side of the industry?
Well, it's interesting. I just we just had a piece a couple of weeks ago where insurers are taking some of this 20% that they're allowed to spend on administrative costs and investing in health IT companies because, you know, they're hoping that there's going to be some return for them. And also, you know, these side businesses they're exempt from the 80-20 ratio that has to go back into patient care. So cost containment technologies are really interesting. Data and analytics, again, care coordination. And it's been a pretty profitable strategy. And if you listen to earnings calls from the big insurers, they're saying, you know, where we really want to invest is in technology.
So I was listening to an earnings call not long ago. It was Joe Schwedes over at WellPoint, which I believe they're changing their name. At WellPoint, and he was very optimistic about the future. I have a hard time sharing that optimism as I look at their business model with that top-end cap through the medical loss ratios. And what I'm hearing you say is that they're becoming very creative in finding new paths for revenue growth through investments in other IT companies. Can you give us an example or two of what carriers are purchasing, and specifically when you say IT companies?
Well, I guess one example, some of the investments aren't direct, I should say. They might be through a venture capital arm. But, you know, you have United Health Group, for instance, with Optum, and that's a technology business. And it's got, you know, while their margin in their core insurance division has been shrinking, in Optum, you know, you're seeing big growth. So that would be one example of where it's worked out.
So let's look down the road a little bit, Beth. And if you're just joining the program, we're talking to Beth Kuchar, who's the healthcare finance reporter with Modern Healthcare. Beth, thank you for joining us today. Yeah. Beth, look down the road a little bit, and you know, I can tell you that I've been in healthcare for over 30 years and have never seen it as crazy as it is right now, with shifting federal and state regulations, obviously, the impact of the Affordable Care Act, the significant changes, the movement from fee-for-service to value-based. What do you see happening, say, after this election and perhaps into 2016?
Well, one thing to keep an eye on is states that have been holdouts in expanding Medicaid and what's going to happen there. One of my favorite stories that I did this year, and I did a version of it last year as well, is the financial performance of hospitals in Medicaid expansion versus non-expansion states. And so last year was about, you know, sort of looking at whether that's going to actually make a difference. And this year, when the early results came in, I think they were even larger than many people expected. So that's going to be, you know, with the shifting regulatory environment, that's definitely going to be one thing to keep an eye on. And then
I was just going to touch on that. We saw Governor Corbett up in Pennsylvania recently has joined in expanding Medicaid, and we see states such as here in Tennessee, where Governor Haslam is—I can only assume—is getting considerable pressure from healthcare organizations here in Nashville to also expand Medicaid. Are you suggesting that more and more of these states are going to bow to that pressure?
I think at some point they almost have to. I mean, I have yet to meet a hospital CEO or CFO who said they wouldn't want Medicaid expansion because of the paying customers that it's going to bring in. You know, there's some thought that maybe after, you know, eventually all states, maybe not all states, but, you know, the tide is just going to build that it does have an impact on hospital finances.
It's obviously having a very positive impact on hospital finances in the states that have expanded Medicaid, because when you look at the organizations that are operating in their states, they're having a much different experience on their income statement and their balance sheet than those that have not expanded it. It's clearly a political issue. And to that end, Beth, before we go, we've got a couple minutes left here, and I'd like to have you weigh in a little bit on, you know, we're looking at the D.C. Court of Appeals vote against the administration relative to insurance subsidies. We then saw very quickly, literally within the same week, a Richmond court vote exactly the opposite of the D.C. court. And we saw it was valid, you know, validating decisions based in Kentucky and Indiana. And it seems like we're on our way to the Supreme Court relative to the employer subsidies. What's your call? What do you think's going to happen?
Oh, it's impossible to say. I think we're too far out.
Seem to be too far out. I would agree with that, but boy, I haven't seen anything as political as this particular issue is. In fact, we already have people saying that when it goes to the full D.C. Court of Appeals, based on the way the Democratic and Republican structure is in that court, it's immediately going to be overturned and reversed, and clearly heading towards the Supreme Court. Beth, I can't thank you enough for being on the show today. We've been talking to Beth Kuchar, who's the healthcare finance reporter at Modern Healthcare. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to Craig Smith. Craig is the president of Coalesce, and Craig will do a best of worst of segment where he's going to share some of his insight and uninsightful conversations that he's had with leadership teams from hospitals and health systems across the country. So we'll be seeing you in a moment. And Beth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Life is full of precious moments, moments that truly matter. And believe it or not, listening to this could actually be one of them. Because at Baptist Health, we want you to know how you might one day save a life. You see, if someone near you suddenly shows signs of a stroke, every moment matters in the race to the right care. Because time lost is brain lost. At Baptist, there are now more options than ever for treating strokes when you get to us in time. Two of the best neurovascular surgeons in the country have joined Baptist to create the new Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center. Coordinating with expert stroke teams across the region, we offer fast access to every advanced treatment available for all strokes. So please, know the signs of a stroke. Call 911 immediately and get to Baptist. Together, we can offer families more precious moments that matter. That's changing healthcare for good. Visit BaptistJax.com to learn more. Again, that's BaptistJax.com.
When it comes to staying well or fighting disease, medicine knows more than it ever has. In fact, more medical knowledge has been created in the last 50 years than in the previous 500 years combined. Think about that. Promising new procedures, innovations in prevention, coming at a faster and faster pace. So how do you get medicine's greatest ideas working for you? It takes a system. At Carolina's healthcare system, thousands of doctors are connected across 900 locations. So doctors, specialists, and surgeons can share ideas across the hall or across the state. Our integrated system gives all your doctors instant access to your test results and health history. So everyone's working together, diagnosing and delivering your care. Today, building this culture of continuous learning takes a system. Connecting a network of care takes a system. Your health takes a system working as one. To find out more, go to carolinashealthcare.org.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are listening to Inside Healthcare with Robert Chamberlain. If you would like to participate on today's show with a question or a comment, please call into our show live on Mondays at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to insidehealthcare@appliedhealth.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Hello and welcome back. This is Robert Chamberlain. I'm your host for Inside Healthcare, Critical Thinking for Turbulent Times. It's the radio show that's intended to take a critical look at this industry and hopefully provide a level of insight that makes very difficult decisions easier to make. We were just talking with Beth Kuchar, who's the finance reporter from Modern Healthcare, sharing her insight on a lot of the merger and acquisition activity and taking place around the country and the reasons and the reasons that it's being driven the way that it is between the for-profits and the not-for-profits and level of collaboration we're seeing as a result. We appreciate her insight. It's always good to have someone such as Beth on the show. And joining us now is Craig Smith, who's the president of Coalesce, which is a healthcare consulting company that works at the C-suite level with hospitals and health systems across the country in trying to help orient and focus their activities specifically around what we call a commercial market strategy, and that is partnering between hospitals, health systems, and employers who are clearly one of the larger purchasers of healthcare. Good morning, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Morning, Bob.
Craig, you spend a lot of time on jets. I know that, and I think that's very important because it's an opportunity for you to sort of have a conversation with the customers out there. And in that instance, it is the C-suite and boardroom level of hospitals and health systems. And we've talked about your experience meeting with a broad spectrum of healthcare executives about how they're addressing the transformation of their business model, which has never been more turbulent than it has been post-Affordable Care Act. Given your focus on creating these mutually beneficial relationship between hospitals, health systems, and employers, can you talk somewhat about the common characteristics of what I would call your best-in-class commercial market strategies?
Bob, I think the first thing I've noticed is the very strong tendency on the part of hospital leadership to think about employers as customers, and to do so in a way that seeks to answer very specifically the question of what it is that employers really need and want. I've also noticed that those who think about this question in the most critical way are keenly aware of their own workforce healthcare benefit cost issues and how those costs are impacting their overall financial performance. Another way of looking at it, it's really a case of being able, you know, to put yourself in the shoes of those you most want to serve.
I got to tell you, that couldn't be more exact. You know, I like to point to Carolina's healthcare system based in Charlotte. They have an internal program that's called LiveWell, which is intended for their 66,000, I'll call owned and managed employees, and it's a very effective population health program that seeks to link these same employees with internal resources inside Carolina's healthcare system with a very strong coaching content and capability that is then externalized, where they're taking their experience internal and providing it externally to employers in the North and South Carolina area. So they're, in essence, commercializing their experience. So what you're saying is that it basically sounds like a need fulfillment type of approach. If that's true, doesn't that consign hospital leadership to develop programming that is specific to every employer they serve? And if that's the case, doesn't that create an inherent challenge to really cost effectively delivering an employer strategy?
It is need fulfillment partnering for sure. And when it's expertly deployed, the program is specific to every employer they serve. That said, the issue of being able to cost effectively scale the strategy can be overcome by developing a delivery mechanism for healthcare services to employees and employers that has broad appeal, that allows for self-selection of the healthcare services that are most needed at the employer site, and finally, that minimizes barriers to access to those services, or even better, provides preferred access to them. So, in essence, when you do this well, the approach is customized by default.
All right, so let's go back to need fulfillment and the issue of specific answers to the question of what employers want. What do they want, Craig?
Employers want several things, but they all fall into the category of delivering value. And in my experience, that means cost reductions, and if that's too much to ask, they at least want to see a reduction in the rate of increase. So price matters for sure. They want location convenience, and the more hospitals and health systems can expand their ambulatory perimeter, the better served that they're going to be. The longer it takes for an employer's workforce to see a physician or other clinician affects productivity, and lost productivity is a bottom line issue. Access and scheduling are corollaries of location convenience, so pairing employees with providers that have capacity is crucial. And finally, outcomes matter. Reducing the variability in care and managing to uniformly desirable outcomes is important to employers. It's important in reality, and it's important to the optics.
And I think what we're experiencing across the country is, in absence of everything you just said, entrepreneurs will rush in, which is why I think we're seeing very significant increase in the growth of on-site clinic strategies, particularly at the employer location. We're seeing more and more companies start to fill that void that is typically left vacant by hospitals and health systems that might be slow to react. But in terms of being able to assemble a portfolio of services that's broad enough to ensure that an employee could effectively self-select virtually any needed service, are there services that you don't recommend to include in an employer-based strategy?
Well, since our focus on this discussion is on common things among best-in-class programs, the thing that I've noticed that executives who are responsible for those programs do is that they tend to focus on what they do well and to minimize exposure to things that they're less adept at doing. The more competitive the market, the more important this is, and it really makes sense that you would only put your best foot forward.
And I would encourage everybody to remember that if you're doing business with the employer, they're taking this very, very seriously, and so you're not necessarily there as the local loved community hospital. You're there as a vendor, and our definition of population health, by the way, spans the gamut from property and casualty to group health. So it ranges everything from occupational health and workers' compensation to the management of health risk present in the workforce. And it's very important to be able to provide that breadth of service to hospitals. But if a hospital doesn't If a hospital doesn't do that, isn't there the potential to cede to a competitor these services and procedures that could otherwise be very profitable for health systems?
I think conceptually that's true. In practice, it's likely that consumers are going to the competitor for those services currently anyway. And that's especially true in markets where there's a low level of employed physician ownership by hospitals and health systems. I wish I could say it never happens in markets where there is a preponderance of system-employed physicians, but there's a surprising amount of leakage in those markets as well. My point is that I'm not sure by adopting a stick-to-the-knitting kind of approach that you're really ceding much to the competition.
Would you suggest to hospital leadership team that steadfastly believed otherwise?
I'd suggest that they look at a few other dimensions of the value equation and try to positively impact those. In other words, I look at achieving some kind of competitive advantage around cost or convenience concerns. And the caveat there is you would do that right up to the point that you feel like the quality of your service matches that of anybody else that you might compete with. Short of that, I'd implore them to put into practice metrics and reporting standards that would allow them, you know, to concretely demonstrate continuing improvement in those services that aren't their current strong suits.
Got it. Before we move to some of the more unusual things you've heard during your meetings, are there any other common themes to the best-in-class programs you've either encountered or built?
There are two that I'd specifically mention. First, the most forward-thinking executives take the long view, which is to say that these are programs and not promotions. You shouldn't get into them and get out of them. These are the kinds of things that you're going to want to commit to in the same way that you'd be committed to any of your other core capabilities as a healthcare provider. And this is a really big deal, I think, in light of the cultural shift that's occurring in healthcare today. Second, the more healthcare executives are able to think like retailers, I think the better served they'll be. We're a long way from having what I would call true consumer-driven healthcare, but the movement in that direction is unmistakable. And I often wonder, you know, who's going to be better, you know, at learning? Retailers having to learn to think like healthcare executives, or healthcare executives having to learn to think like retailers?
So it's really interesting because hospitals and health systems, despite the stress and the pressure resulting from changes in state and federal regulations and everything that they're trying to administer and manage relative to data integration, new payment models, physician alignments, they're now as it relates to becoming a vendor or a partner with employers, they also now have to think like a carrier. They have to act like a disease management company. They need to recognize the needs of the employer as a customer and start to build into their quiver of arrows greater capabilities that may be new and uncommon to these groups. So let me ask you this, Craig. Let's talk for a minute about some of the unusual things that you've learned recently that you've heard. Can you give me an example of something that you might have wanted to respond to but didn't?
Yeah, you know, most of the people I meet with, and this isn't a paid commercial announcement, it's the gospel truth, you know, are very smart, very thoughtful, very committed people. So I rarely find myself having to resist the temptation to roll my eyes. But recently, one that I heard that I was kind of shocked by was simply that, you know, employers don't really care about healthcare benefit costs. Now, a little context here. I was in Northern California, you know, in the Silicon Valley area of the state. It's a part of the state that's characterized by high employment, a fair amount of wealth, frankly. Pretty healthy market, not a small number of what we would refer to as the young invincibles. You know, so on the face of it, I didn't want to, you know, let this individual see my head kind of fly off. But his comment about they don't really care about healthcare benefit costs. What they care about is delivering a competitive benefit package so they could sustain the employment of the best and the brightest. On the face of it, that seemed odd to me, simply because if you think about what constitutes a great benefit package, it tends to have, a broad network of providers. It tends to have, a lot of services that can be pricey. And so at the end of the day, those are the kinds of employers that typically are facing the greatest increase in their healthcare benefit costs. The other thing that was significant to me about it is that I was staying near the airport and only had about a 10 to 15 mile drive from my hotel room down to this meeting, and I passed literally three very large health systems or properties that were owned by competitive health systems, from my perspective, if they had great reimbursement, if they had young invincibles, it's all the same for everybody, everybody's doing well, if that's really the case, then it becomes an issue about market share movement. Another one that I thought was interesting recently was a conversation that I had with an individual who said, yeah, they were very interested in looking at the employer market and saw that as premium reimbursement and therefore better than government or self-pay. But within about 15 minutes of having that sort of introduction to their desire to serve the employer market, as we started talking about what they were doing, I don't know if it was embarrassment for lack of a better term, a lapse of forethought, but they couldn't share with me that they were doing an awful lot to serve the employer market. And ultimately, I heard this statement is, well, you know what, as the more I think about this, the less important I think the market is going to be, the employer market is going to be to us, because most employers are going to move to a defined contribution approach and get out of the business of making healthcare benefit plan choices on behalf of their employees. We'll see what happens with the employer mandate. That would certainly impact that movement. But what was interesting to me is that while none of us have a crystal ball, and I can't say that it happened, it's certainly not happening now in any material way. And I'm not certain that I would want to time that, my marketing or strategic decisions on what the government may or may not do or may or may not enforce as it relates to their own policies. I enjoyed hearing recently that a particular system was operating in this great reimbursement area, and everybody looked the same. And to my point earlier is that this is a market share movement issue, and if that's the case, you better be delivering real competitive value.
We heard from Beth Kuchar earlier today, and again, Beth is the healthcare finance reporter with Modern Healthcare, that there's significant financial pressure on balance sheets and income statements, particularly in the not-for-profit sector, Craig. I'm curious as to, again, you started off by mentioning the level of sophistication of the people that you're working with, and that's clearly the same experience that I have. But to me, it almost seems like I'll use the term no-brainer, that if you're facing this financial pressure on your income statement, wouldn't the commercial market be a great big target for you?
Absolutely. You call it no-brainer. My phrase for it is it's a no-regrets strategy. Beth made the comment about the investment that hospitals and health systems have made in EMRs, EHRs, buying physician practices, and too early to tell yet whether or not those investments are paying off. I absolutely agree with Beth that it's too early to tell whether or not they're paying off. But a lot of the people that I talk to who are responsible for managing large employed groups are telling me that not only is it not paying off as it relates to, seeing increased downstream referrals, but it's not paying off relative to the productivity that those practices were experiencing when they were owned by someone other than the health system. They actually saw productivity decrease after the purchase by the health system. So as it relates to the no-brainer, no regrets, my point simply is that it's an absolute fundamental given that there are only three ways that hospitals, or three sources of reimbursement for hospitals and health systems. It's government pay, it's self-pay, and it's employer. Those employers are in their market. They've been there for years. The hospitals are in their market. They've been there for years. They're looking for solutions, and there's never been a better time to be speaking to them about the issues that matter most to employers as a means of getting in front of those customers who represent the best reimbursement.
Yeah, and I think the thing that the interesting juxtaposition that I see, given Beth's comment on how hospital and health system income statements and balance sheets are financially struggling, is the outlay of very, very important capital against an investment called a primary care physician that is then sub-optimized by not steering more of an investment strategy in the direction in the support of that practice.
That's right, Bob. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention as it relates to return on investment and this being a no-brainer / no-regret strategy is that the level of investment that's required for these programs, while not insignificant, is significantly less than, you know, the millions that they're spending on EMRs, EHRs, and physician practices. And the returns are much more measurable, much more immediate.
Well, we've been talking to Craig Smith. And Craig, thank you for being on the show today. We hope you enjoyed it. Remember to come back next Monday at 8 a.m. Central Time. Next week, our host will be Jeff Trinquan, who's the first vice president of Alliant Employee Benefits. Jeff is going to be here to talk about what's happening in that end of the business. So thank you all very much, and we look forward to being with you again next Monday.
Thank you for joining us this week for Inside Healthcare. Robert Chamberlain will be back live next week on Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, 6 a.m. Pacific Time. You may also catch our weekly replay on Saturdays at noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, both on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll see you on the next show.